Before presenting the opening program of Behold a Woman, we want you to know something about our leading character. He will introduce himself.
I am John Archer. I'm 39 years old, lean, a trifle over 6 feet tall. My hair, originally chestnut, is somewhat faded from much sun. My nose is more aquiline than straight, and my dark eyes peer at you from a face that never seems to lose its tan, summer or winter. I had my beginning in England, not that I retain any of the speech peculiarities or mannerisms of the mother country. My 15 years of childhood in the British Isles have been entirely overshadowed by 6 years at sea in tramps, 2 years with Scotland Yard, and stretches of pearling, whaling, prospecting for oil in far-off desert lands. Long before the war, I made it my business to appear wherever trouble promised. In China, in Spain, in the Holy Land. By the time the war came to the United States, I had taken my citizenship in this country. I was proud to serve her in both the Eastern and Western theaters. I flew the hump. I was a saboteur behind the German lines. And I put in 2 years of activities still listed top secret in the War Department's files. And yet, I was never a true soldier of fortune. Through all my travels and adventures, I retained always in the back of my mind the dream of a home I should someday build in which to contemplate at my leisure the experiences of a dozen commonplace lifetimes. From far-off places, I bought and sent back the materials that should one day go into my dream home. And now, it's a reality. Perched high atop a hill, faced with rugged fieldstone from the Pyrenees, redwood from the big forest, shingled and thatched with tough papyrus rushes from the Nile, carpeted with grass rugs from Polynesia. The railing of the balcony that looks down a sheer drop of 300 feet is giant bamboo from Malaya. The curtain that drapes the great windows is a woven seaweed fishnet from the south of Chile. This huge music room in which I spend many hours of contemplation and relaxation is my particular joy. Designed to my own specifications, it has a ceiling full 2 stories high. The granite fireplace is high enough for me to stand in it erect, and the room itself accommodates my harp, my organ, my concert grand piano, and my thousands of books and souvenirs with ease. 3 whole walls are a sheer expanse of glass. A sweep of the eye takes in a breathless panorama of 100 miles from the snow-capped Sierras across the restless, checkered city below and out to the blue Pacific. To glance about my room, one would take me for a collector of curious and unrelated objects from the far corners of the world. It's true, I am a collector, but not of the objects themselves so much as of the memories they bring back to me. This Ming vase has a story. So has this small polished stone that looks like a garnet but isn't. Here is a rough-hewn wooden trencher from a Normandy farmhouse. And there is a weather-beaten barometer whose needle points out words in angular Russian letters. All have stories. And from time to time, I shall tell you about them. Strangely, the stories are of women. It's surprising even to me how large a part women have played in the unfolding of my wandering life. My memories bring me many and varied women. The beautiful and the plain, the good and the evil, the cold and the ardent, the grasping and the helpless. Wherever I go, I add to my collection new memories to place alongside the old. Perfect strangers will come to me unbidden and offer new gems for my collection. Is there something about me that prompts these confidences? Perhaps. I do not know. I only know that the stories come, and I welcome and treasure them. And ever after, a snatch of melody, the slow curve of smoke from my pipe, a restless movement from Brutus, the great Dane who dozes at my feet, will bring them to life again. From this room, I shall greet you each day. We shall talk of many things. As the mood dictates, we shall have music, a dash of salty philosophy, a few lines of verse, perhaps. And the mood will inevitably call up memories from a full life, an eager, inquiring mind, and, if I must confess it, a leaning toward the romantic. We shall range far, but ever our theme will be woman and the things that pertain to woman. What she says and what she means when she says it, what she thinks and does and why, what she wears and how, what raises her to the pedestal of adoration and what drags her to the dust. All that is woman is grist for our mill. Yes, we shall talk of many things, but not one uncolored or unmotivated by the small, soft hand of a woman.
And now, if you'll please turn this transcription over, here is our first show.
Behold a woman. Her perfume is a headiness in my nostrils. Her daintiness is a gladness in my eyes. Aye, the love of a woman is the true haven of man.
This morning, we want you to behold a woman seen through the eyes of John Archer as he sits in the music room of his hilltop home looking west to the Pacific. Behold a woman. Any woman. All women.
Good morning. The sunlight slants over the keys of my piano and on the broad bosom of the Pacific over the edge of the hills. She's tranquil today, the sea, deceptively tranquil, but she does not fool me. I put too many years dancing attendance on her moods. I know they are many and quick changing, like the moods of a woman, for the aspect of woman is endless. When you walk into a room for the first time, do you look first at the titles of the books? Do you pride yourself that you can tell the character of the owner by his books? Then perhaps you can tell me, who was Anne Lang? What manner of person was she? I never met her, for she died long before I was born. I have only part of her library for clues. Books picked up at a shabby stall on the Thames Embankment. Here they are, dozens of faded, torn paperback novels. The titles are stilted and amusing, and the pen drawings on the covers of hoop-skirted women and mutton-chopped men take you instantly back to another day. A day when the young Victoria ruled Britain's land with her beloved consort, Albert. On the flyleaf of each tawdry romance, in faded childish script is written,
"This book belongs to Anne Lang."
You think you know her? She read trash and penny dreadfuls. An apple-cheeked scullery maid? Perhaps. A bit of the human flotsam that surges and struggles for a meager existence in London's teeming slums? Who was Anne Lang? Perhaps the most surprising thing about her is that she could read at all. Yet here among the cheap and shabby paperbacks is a strange thing. A book of poems, leather-bound and gold-edged. Obviously worth much, much more than the purse of a scullery maid could afford. Let's open it. There is a bookmark from the Library of Buckingham Palace, and in a regal hand on the flyleaf,
"Some services can never be fully repaid. May this token, dear girl, ever remind you of the gratitude of your queen. To Anne Lang, from Victoria Regina, October 4th, 1839.
What service had Anne Lang, the scullery maid with a head filled with impossible romances, have performed for her queen? I have searched the history books in vain. They tell me nothing. I have only the trashy novels, the elegant volume of poetry with its regal inscription, and, of course, beneath the queen's signature, the awkward scrawl once more.
This book belongs to Anne Lang.
Who was Anne Lang? Of all the instruments I play, the organ will always be, I suppose, my first love. My mother, rest her soul, had great plans for me once. It was her fondest dream that I should someday become a fellow of music at Oxford, and in time be knighted as first organist of St. Paul's, which means, of course, first organist in the kingdom. Not an easy dream to realize, and one that will, I'm afraid, never come true. But I never cease thanking my mother every time I draw out the gorgeous sound of this king of instruments for daring to dream magnificently. All mothers, of course, dare and dream for their children, boldly or modestly, according to their lights. Nancy Hanks was a humble woman, and she dreamed humbly. She died when her son, Abraham Lincoln, was 9 years old.
If Nancy Hanks came back as a ghost, seeking news of what she loved most, she'd ask first, "Where's my son? What's happened to Abe? What's he done?" Poor little Abe, left all alone, except for Tom, who's a rolling stone. He was only 9 the year I died. I remember still how hard he cried. Scraping along in a little shack with hardly a shirt to cover his back and a prairie wind to blow him down, or pinching times if he went to town. You wouldn't know about my son. Did he grow tall? Did he have fun? Did he learn to read? Did he get to town? Do you know his name? Did he get...